Hello and welcome to another episode of the CBO Speaks podcast. I'm your host, Donna Shealy. Glad you all could join us today. Today's guest is Anne Bordelon. She is Executive Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration at the University of Arkansas. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Donna. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, we are so excited to have you. I'm glad we were able to catch up with you. So I know we want to talk about all the things that you're doing at the University of Arkansas, but I want you to take us all the way back to your undergrad days and talk to us about how you got to the University of Arkansas.
Well, I probably wouldn't have gotten to the University of Arkansas had I not been a student at the University of Arkansas. So
there you go.
I am a native Arkansan, though my father was a career military officer. And so I didn't grow up in Arkansas, but I grew up a lifelong Razorback fan because of my parents. And so we did live in Fayetteville when I was in junior high because my dad's military assignment was to teach ROTC here at the University of Arkansas. So I actually lived here and, when I was in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, and really loved the community. And a lot of my friends at the time, their parents were faculty members, so I spent a lot of time around campus. And so when it became time to choose a college, the University of Arkansas was high on my list, and it was an easy place to come back to, even though we weren't living in Arkansas. That really cemented my connection, obviously, to the university. And over the course of my career, I have continued to be involved at the university, whether as a donor, a guest speaker. I've served on a number of committees over the years. I was on the Walton College of Business Dean's Executive Advisory Board for many years, served as chair of that. And at some point, somebody approached me about taking this job. We can go through the progression to that, but it was that connection probably is what made this happen, because I'm not sure that I would do this job at any other university. Because of the background of my career, higher ed is so different from what I've done most of my career.
So your major, when you were matriculating at the University of Arkansas, what was your major?
It was accounting and information systems.
Was that your plan? You're like, you know what? I'm going to be an accountant. That's my goal. That's what I want to do.
It was. I took an accounting class in high school, and I thought, this all makes a lot of sense to me. And I knew that, you know, being a CPA would be a good career. And so I came to the University of Arkansas with the expectation of being of getting an accounting degree. I did add information systems along the way, which was a good add. And I didn't really think about anything other than being an accounting major. And the program kept my interest, so I never changed majors when I was here. I might have changed my perspective on what electives I would take, but really, I had always been an accounting major.
Awesome. So once you graduated, what was the first career that you went into?
Public accounting. I went to work for Ernst & Young. Actually, I accepted my job with Arthur Young. And because of the consolidation that happened the summer that I graduated, it was Ernst & Young by the time I started my job. You know, I think the Big Eight went to the Big Six maybe at the time. And so I went to work for EY in Little Rock, which was great because it was a relatively smaller office as those firms' offices go, which gave me a lot of opportunity to serve a number of different clients in a number of different industries. So I had banks, I had media companies, I had the world's largest poultry company as my client. I had agricultural clients, so I really got really broad experience in learning how different businesses operate, so which was really great for the rest of my career, for sure.
So then you moved into, was that when you went into Walmart after you left Ernst & Young?
No. First, I actually went to work for Tyson Foods, which was
okay.
My client.
Was your client. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I left EY, well, first of all, a lot of people leave big public accounting firms in their, you know, second, third year, after their second or third year. So I wasn't unusual in that regard. My husband wanted to go back to school, and he wanted to come to Northwest Arkansas to Fayetteville so that we could so he could re-enroll here. And then Tyson's headquarters is nearby, so they had approached me about coming to work for a new part of the organization they were forming. And I took that opportunity to come back to Fayetteville and go to work for Tyson Foods. And I worked in the retail sales and marketing organization as their finance and IT liaison, and really was their connection to the corporate center, accounting, financial reporting, IT, all of the kind of the centralized corporate functions, which was a great job and really gave me good perspective and made me realize I liked retail, which is, you know, important later on as well. And I was at Tyson for about 5 years. I got to a point there, though, I was kind of, you know, very probably early into what I would call the middle part of my career. And I was really unclear about what my career could be at Tyson. And I had done a number of jobs there, which were all great, but I was really didn't understand what my career was going to be there. And also, EY was knocking on my door again about, hey, maybe you should come back to EY. So I did. I actually left Tyson, went back to work at EY. And in those days, it was before all of the Sarbanes-Oxley rules, Tyson immediately became my client again. So I spent, a good portion of my work day at Tyson anyway. And it was great. And also, but at the same time, I had an opportunity not too long after I had rejoined EY, an opportunity surfaced on the Walmart account as well. So for most of the next 5 years, the only two clients I served were Tyson and Walmart. Every once in a while, I had another client, but the rest of the time I was at EY, it was Tyson and Walmart, which, you know, you really can't complain about to Fortune 100 clients like that, and the experience that I got. So I stayed at EY for another 5 years. I was really at the point where I was going to have to choose being a partner or doing something else. And Walmart had actually approached me a number of times about coming to work for them in the 5 years that I was there at EY, and they were my client. And I held them off for a while. I had a lot of perceptions about Walmart that weren't positive. And I thought, you know, is that really where I want to spend my career? But over that last year that I was, they really convinced me that a lot of those perceptions were just that. They were perceptions. They weren't true. So in 2003, I went to be the assistant controller for Walmart. I became responsible for the public financial reporting, among other things. I was promoted to a vice president within the year or just maybe right around a year. That set off a 13-year, almost 13-year career at Walmart, which was amazing. I did all different sorts of finance job there, and I would say probably the second job that I had at Walmart was probably the key job that really changed the trajectory of my career. I had always looked at myself as an accountant or a controller type person. And when I went to Walmart, I thought, oh, well, my aspiration is to be the controller, the chief accounting officer for the company. In my first job there, I had the opportunity to co-lead the implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley at Walmart, which was a huge undertaking. And I, along with the chief audit executive, led that. And through the course of that project, a number of things about Walmart's organization were revealed, and Walmart decided to put additional resources, higher level resources, in certain key operating areas. And I was actually asked to go lead the finance organization that supported the real estate function. So think about an organization that develops real estate 400 stores a year, opening three or 400 stores a year, operating thousands of Walmart stores, maintaining a huge corporate office. It's just a huge real estate function. And by the way, I knew nothing, really nothing about real estate. I didn't have any real real estate experience other than what any of my college courses might have touched on, which wasn't a lot. And it was a true finance job. It was not an account. There were accounting aspects to it, of course, but it was really more of a corporate finance job. And until I had that job, I'd always looked at myself more of a controllership. And it was really in that job I learned, oh, I do have capacity to be a CFO and to really think about all of these other aspects. But the other thing that was great about that job was there were great and terrible at the same time, where there were a lot of problems at the time in the real estate function, which is one of the reasons that I was asked to go over there. And I learned, you know, we had some accounting issues, which is where my experience came in positioning me to be helpful in that role. But the team also was not respected by the business side of the organization. They were viewed as barriers to getting things done. They were, you know, inhibited the productivity of the function. They were bureaucratic and said no a lot and weren't viewed as helpful in enabling the business. And so I had to also at the same time learn how to build relationships with my new business partners, build credibility for my team, turn around some of these accounting issues, and all the while figure out how to be a more of a finance person than an accounting person.
Right.
So you can see for me, I think this was, of all of the jobs I've held, this was probably the job where I had the most personal growth. It was probably the hardest job I had ever had, if I think back, only because I think, you know, there were so many things, so many tensions in that job at first. And, you know, there were times when I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to leave Walmart. I'm going to leave this job. This is too much. And then it got better and we made a lot of progress. I was able to develop those relationships. We were able to kind of change the culture of the team, which unfortunately meant a lot of the team wasn't the same team at the end that started with me. Because the expectations were higher and different. But again, it ended up being just an incredible experience of personal growth. And it made me realize I had probably maybe shortchanged. There's nothing wrong with a controllership career, by the way, but I had shortchanged my own self in thinking that and limiting my own view of what I could do or what my aspirations were. And after, you know, as I moved through that job, I really changed my mindset about what I wanted to do, and I did ultimately become a CFO of a very large division of Walmart. But in between that and the real estate job, I became a senior vice president and led the global internal audit function for Walmart. And so I had teams, 400 people scattered around the globe. Anywhere Walmart had operations, I had a team, and which was an amazing experience in and of itself. I got to travel a ton. I learned about, you know, all the different cultures. I spent a lot of time in those markets. And also at the time, globalizing a function that was really at the time just independent internal audit functions that were very much focused locally. And we turned that into a very risk-based, global-minded audit organization where people would have the opportunity to travel outside their market to other markets for their own personal growth. But from that job, I did move on into a Sam's Club and became the CFO of Sam's Club, which at the time was a $50 billion company, which, you know, in and of itself would have been a pretty high up on the Fortune 500 list, even without being attached to Walmart. So that was a phenomenal experience. I worked with great leaders who have moved on to be CEOs of very well-respected companies that you would recognize. And so I can't deny the mentorship that I received from those amazing leaders. But my time at Sam's Club was phenomenal. I had worked with a leadership, executive leadership team that was super aligned and had a very strong strategy. And there's nothing better than having a super aligned leadership team and a focused strategy. It really makes a big difference. And so that was a great experience.
Talk to us a little bit more about the mentorship, because, you know, you had a fantastic career at Walmart. Ernst & Young, too, we're not going to minimize that. But to end up being the CFO of Sam's Club and to be the CFO of Walmart Asia and the global things that you've done and executive areas there. I mean, my goodness. Talk to us a little bit about the mentorship and the leadership that you were just talking about as you were going through, and kind of even when you talked about how you changed your mind from that audit to the finance, you know, and who was talking to you and saying, you know what, you can do this.
Well, I've been very blessed with a strong circle of mentors and sponsors. And, you know, I think it's important to, there's a very big difference between mentorship and sponsorship. And sometimes those are the same people and sometimes they're different people. I probably at the time didn't appreciate all of that as I do now, but I look back on my career and there have been a handful of people who have really been instrumental. And I'll go back to my days at Ernst & Young, and Kathy Gates was the person who hired me at Ernst & Young. She was a senior accountant at the time. She ultimately went on to leave the Little Rock office, went on to Tulsa, became a partner in Tulsa, and she's the one that recruited me to be on the Walmart account. And then when I left to go to Walmart, she ultimately became the managing partner of the Tulsa office of Ernst & Young. But we always remained in close contact with each other, and she's always been the person who... She's one of the first phone calls I've made when I've ever had a big challenge or thinking about making a change in my career or whatever it was. She's been there all along the way, and that still remains true today. And there was another partner in the EY office, Johnny McCaleb, who I think was a great mentor of mine very early in my career. When I transitioned to Walmart, I was very fortunate that my supervisor in my first job, who I worked with in most of the time over the course of my career, he was either my boss or was a peer, or, you know, we had a very strong connection throughout my time at Walmart. But if it hadn't been for him, Charles Hawley is his name, he did ultimately become the CFO of Walmart. He invested a tremendous amount of time and effort into me. I remember shortly after coming to Walmart, they put people who they believe might be vice presidents through a pretty significant development program where you're analyzed and probed and prodded, and they give you a 200-page binder telling you all the things that are wrong with you, and like one page of here's what you're strong in, but he really required me to come up with an individualized development plan. His standard of that plan was super high. So I think I had 5 versions of it before he was satisfied, because it just wasn't specific enough for him ever. So he was super invested in that. And he personally managed me through that development plan. He advocated for me when there were opportunities. I got to participate in a executive development program with 9 other Walmart colleagues through Dartmouth, where we traveled around the world to, we spent time in India, we spent time in China, we spent time on Dartmouth's campus. And that was just a phenomenal experience and really helped me become a much more strategic leader. But I think about him, but I will also say the most important thing besides Charles's investment in me was the strong network of executive women that already existed at Walmart. And I was so fortunate that I wasn't the first anything at Walmart. There were already women who were executive vice presidents. There had already been women's CFOs of divisions. So it wasn't unheard of for there to be very senior executive women. And we were a tight group of very networked women. And these were women that I didn't necessarily work with all day or even very closely with. And what was great about that was they had no skin in the game for me. So they were very willing to give me the feedback and hard truths that maybe other people that were closer to me wouldn't. And so I really appreciated the things that were in place at Walmart. It was a very informal group. We called ourselves the Women Officer Caucus. It was anyone who was a female who was a vice president or above. That group still exists. And today they even have alumni gatherings. And so they'll invite us all back to come and share and mentor the current group of women. So it's a phenomenal group of women. And it's not even a real part of Walmart. I mean, it's just something that was formed and just, you know, got legs and continues to exist. So I really appreciate the group of women that really took the care from, took me under their wing, placed their care in me and constructive criticism in a way that helped me grow.
Wow. Pretty remarkable. So after that wonderful career with Walmart, you retired. What year was that you retired?
2015. So yeah, nine and a half years ago. I failed at retirement.
Yeah.
I failed.
Air quotes, failed retired. So what did you do once you were retired?
My plan was to become a serial board member. That was my plan. I was going to, you know, get on a few public company boards and, you know, enjoy my flexibility. But I did take 6 months off and didn't really do anything, which was great. It was great. And, you know, I think anyone who has tried to get on boards or serves on public company boards knows how hard that is. And it really is about a strong network and timing. And it's not for an impatient person, for sure, trying to navigate that. In the meantime, while I was figuring out how I was going to do that, some colleagues of mine that I had known from Walmart and actually one from the Walton College Advisory Board had started a venture capital fund and asked me if I would work with them at one of their portfolio companies that had just started. So I like to say I went from the world's largest company to the world's smallest because it was a startup company. It was about as close to pre-revenue as you can be without actually being pre-revenue. So I spent a couple of years there working as their CFO and helped them accounting software implemented. And we went through a fundraise and raised some capital for the company, put some processes in place, and I kind of worked myself out of a job. I was also an investor in the company, and I kind of felt like it was probably a better use of their limited cash and paying a controller at this point than having a real CFO for that stage. So once we kind of got the foundation set, I kind of stepped out of that. But it was a great experience working with a startup. But I learned a lot about myself in that, what I loved and what I didn't love. And as much as I did love the entrepreneurial spirit and I loved the agility of that organization, but I also learned that I really thrive in a situation of complexity and of also with I really do prefer larger organizations where I have a strong peer group. I had a great relationship with the CEO of the startup and with the other leaders there. It was really interesting to me because those were things I didn't really know about myself, but I learned. And so after that, I went and spent a few years with a subsidiary company of a global media company. And the strategy was supposed to be that there was going to be a lot of M&A activity to build out this particular function within the global firm. And ultimately the global firm de-emphasized that strategy. And then I decided to step away from that opportunity because it wasn't what it was originally supposed to be. And that's when the university came calling.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So the university is calling. And what was that conversation like? And how did that turn into you saying, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah, I had mentioned that I had served on the Walton College of Business's Dean's Advisory Board, and I had continued that service post my Walmart career. It was the dean of the business school that called me and asked me to lunch, which wasn't unusual. So I went to lunch with him, and he said, told me that this job was going to open up, and he said, I think you should apply. And I said, Matt, I don't know. It's higher ed is so different. I don't know if I'm cut out for that bureaucracy and slow movement. It's a state entity. And said, but I do love the University of Arkansas. And anyway, he continued to put the pressure on me. And so I relented, and I thought, what the heck? I'll see what this is about. I'll put my documents together and submit them. And the entire interview process was so foreign to me. And I mean, it's such a different interview process in higher ed than it is in corporate America. So, I mean, there were a number of times through the process, I kept thinking, oh, this isn't what I want to do. It was only because of the weirdness of the interview process. But so somehow I ended up on the, even though it was a national search, I ended up on the side of the job offer, which was great. I got the job offer on March 8th of 2020.
Oh my.
The next week, the country shut down, I think. The dates are a little fuzzy, but it was definitely March, and I got the offer, and then a week later, the country shut down. And I thought, what have I done? Yeah, but I had also, so it was March. I didn't start the job until July. That was because the university was also going through a workday implementation, and I decided that I did not want to start before that was live. So I strategically started on the day it went live. Happy to help fix whatever's broken, but I didn't want to be
a part of the startup of
the initial. So I started it in COVID on a brand new software application that went live during COVID when nobody was inside, you know, together to try to solve problems, you know, around a table. So that was interesting. Oh, and by the way, in between there, I joined two public company boards. Because I had been successful in that pursuit all the while. So in between 2019 and 2020, I was asked to serve on two boards. And I continue to do that today, which is great. So I not only did I have to learn higher ed, I learned it during COVID in the midst of a financial and human resources ERP implementation.
Right. What was that like?
Yeah, it was hard. While I knew a lot of people on campus, the people who were my direct reports, except for one, I did not know them. I did not have a previous relationship with them. The first few months, I spent a lot of time just in one-on-one meetings on a listening tour of my direct reports, of their direct reports, of deans, of all of the other vice chancellors, just really trying to establish what relationship I could and understanding their priorities. Where did they see opportunity for me to make the campus better from a support and enabling their strategic plans? And so a lot of listening, and all the while trying to figure out how we were going to make stabilize workday. In fact, I remember one time going to the chancellor, telling him, it's probably two or three months in, I said, I think you're going to have to hire another vice chancellor for finance and administration because I'm the workday project manager right now. Yeah, it took a good probably 18 months to really get workday stabilized. I mean, I don't think it'll be a never ending pursuit of optimization, but, it was probably 18 months, and it took a lot of my focus in that, especially in that first year. I mean, probably well more than 50% of my focus. I had to just assume the other things were going okay. I had a good team. I had a strong team, which enabled me to do that, of course. So, and of course it was because of COVID, construction projects mostly came to a stop. There was a lot of things that relaxed some areas that normally would be require a lot more areas of focus. So you know, I was probably a year. I don't even count the first year, even because, you know, to me, it was like year zero, not year one, because of COVID. And I, you know, I've been here 3.5 years, a little over 3.5 years now. And I feel like last year was really the first year that I really got the things that were in my mind that first year going, you know, from a transformational perspective. And really thinking about what is my thumbprint on how we serve, how the Division of Finance Administration serves campus. So there's a lot going on here at the University of Arkansas. I'm excited about it, but we've got a lot of things on everyone's plate right now, including Workday still. I mean, because again, it's 3 years old. We're still learning a lot about it and continuously optimizing it. So. That'll, like I said, it'll never be off the list, I don't think.
Well, what is everything that you are responsible for at the University of Arkansas?
Yeah, it is much more than just finance. So I have all right. of the typical treasury, finance kinds of stuff, financial reporting, but I also have procurement. I also have the facilities reports to me, parking and transit, the police department, IT, HR. I'm sure I'm leaving something out. The bookstore, the tech mm-hmm. store. I like to say anything that I'm responsible for everything finance, and then everything administrative that's not academic or student facing. So student affairs doesn't report to me. So housing and dining report in that. But basically everything that supports campus wide is in my organization. So, you know, and people a lot of times ask me, how is this different than Walmart? And I would say that my jobs at Walmart had a lot of scale, obviously, because of the size. But my breadth of my jobs was narrower than what I have here, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you about being a student there. And now you are a, you know, vice chancellor for finance and administration. So how is that? I mean, I know that has to be fulfilling. Obviously, you went there, but the changes that you're seeing from when you were there as a student to now, talk to me a little bit about how that has been for you.
Well, it's been amazing. And honestly, it was one of the draws. No matter what organization I was working for, one of the things that I love being a part of recruiting college students to come work for it, whether it was EY, whether it was Tyson, whether it was Walmart. And I just love being part of a young person's journey. And I think that's because I had there were such important people that were part of my journey early in my career. I just want to pay that forward. And I get a lot of personal reward and benefit from those interactions. And so whether it's going and being a guest lecturer in a classroom, whether it's, you know, every once in a while, I'll come across some students and it will turn into a mentoring relationship, or even, you know, people who are here on campus who are staff members or faculty members that are early in their career. I love just spending time with them and understanding where they are and what their mindset is. It also helps me, by the way, because I think, number one, it helps me remain relevant because I understand what's going on and in the way that they're thinking about the world and their future, but also it gives me perspective of their view, you know, what they're seeing from where they sit, whether they're a staff person or a faculty member or a student. I mean, what are their challenges? What are the things that are happening that we aren't making easy for them? Because that's what I view my organization's job is. My job is to make everyone else's job easier, whether that's because we're being more productive or more efficient or less costly to our students. That's the mission of the Division of Finance and Administration. So anytime I get to spend time with students is amazing to me. I'm also an advisor for my sorority, so I have that connection too here on campus. And then next fall, I've agreed to co-teach a honors colloquium at the Walton College with the dean of the business school. So I'm looking forward to that as well. So dipping my toe into the teaching full-time a real class other than just being a guest lecturer.
Oh my goodness. And you just stay busy.
The student interaction to me is, I get so much energy from that. And because it's a constant reminder of why the university is important and what we're here to do.
That's right. What are some of the, when you were talking about how you talk to them and some of the concerns that they may have as they move forward, as they're going through school, what is one that kind of stands out that you see that students and staff, I guess, are more concerned with nowadays in 2024?
Oh, that's a great question. I think on the staff side, probably a little bit easier to answer. I think one of the things that I hear most often is, I don't know what my career path can be. And we don't make it easy for them because we're super decentralized. We have not had a job classification and compensation structure that makes it easy for you to move between units, because typically the units that have the most money price up the jobs. And so, equivalent jobs in one unit may pay differently than the same job in a different unit. We're working to change all of that, by the way. But I do. So there's barriers, I think. We also don't. So in addition to not having good career pathing for people, I think we could do a much better job of on the development side and being more intentional about developing people. I think they're obviously, just like anywhere, there's people who are really good at that. And they love that as a supervisor or a manager. But, I think in a lot of cases, I'm not sure everybody realizes that's their responsibility. That's not something that's, I think, in the cultural DNA here. And I would love for it to be. Another big vision of ours within our HR team is to really develop a very sophisticated talent management program that allows us to identify who are our top performers, regardless of what unit they are in, and be real intentional about developing them over their career so they can serve in jobs like mine or, any other job. Why should we have to go do a national search? We shouldn't. We should be able to build our own talent. We have enough people here on this campus. we could certainly do that. So that's an audacious goal in higher ed, but it is something I think is worth pursuing for sure. On the student side, the biggest complaint I hear is about parking, of course, but
of course,
what can I do about parking?
Right.
No, but I think, it's just like, I think anywhere else, I don't think it's anything special. It's what can I expect out of my career? People come to me, they recognize I have done a lot of different things. I've had a successful career. So the questions are more about, how did I navigate my career? How did I choose to go to EY versus the other options I had? And why, and how did I make those choices along the way? Those are the most common things that I get. It's actually very helpful for me to have those conversations, because it's a good reminder of me to remember the things that made me successful and whether or not I continue to use those things. So it is sometimes very introspective for me to have to think about those things, because they were, 30 years ago, and the memory is getting a little fuzzy now. So it keeps it fresh, but I do really enjoy that.
That's awesome. Well, before we close, I want to get your perspective on the future of higher ed and the CBO role. As we move forward, we are hearing about the enrollment cliff and all these different things. What do you see is the future for higher ed, and specifically the role of the CBO?
Well, I see a couple of things, and I don't think anything I'm going to say will be a surprise to anybody or anything that's a super different perspective. But obviously, the enrollment cliff is on everyone's mind, and we have a debate about how severe it will be here. I do think we're very well positioned as the flagship of the state of Arkansas and the only R1 university in the state. We also are an incredible value to the surrounding states. So we draw a lot of out-of-state students here. In fact, the out-of-state students create a financial benefit for us that allows us to redeploy some of those dollars into our Arkansans. So we do strategically think about our out-of-state enrollment as a way to subsidize our Arkansans, which is that's why we're here. We're the land-grant school of Arkansas, and so we want to be the destination of choice for any Arkansan. Maintaining that affordability for all students, but especially Arkansans, is the highest goal that we have. And so we're doing things like I said, making sure that we're investing some of that tuition benefit we get from out of state back into Arkansans. We have a very robust transfer program from the two-year institutions for some of our most popular degree programs here on campus. And so people can transfer from any two-year college and pay the same tuition they were paying at the two-year college to take courses here at the University of Arkansas, which is a great benefit. It's really been a great program because those students come here. They've got 2 years under their belt. They're prepared. The retention has so far been very good. And so I think that will help us in the cliff as well. Like everyone else, we're focusing on graduate education and making sure that our programs are where they need to be there. So the cliff is, high on our minds. The good news is we've been so fortunate to have strong enrollment for the last several years. In 2019, our fall enrollment was just over 27,000. This past fall, our enrollment was just over 32,000. And we definitely expect to be knocking on the door of 33,000, possibly exceeding 33,000 in fall 2024. So good growth trajectory for the University of Arkansas. Our challenge is more what is our capacity question versus, oh no, the cliff is coming. And although we're having to balance both and plan for both, I mean, obviously we don't believe that we'll continue to have the strong 5 to 10 to 15% growth that we've seen over the last few years over the short term horizon. But right now, next year looks great. We still think the next year is good and probably a little bit of a question mark 3 years out. So we're doing things like really thinking about how are we going to manage housing? Right now, we don't have enough beds, so we're master leasing apartment plexes and things like that. We're having to weigh the benefit. Do we build another dorm, knowing the cliff is coming? And I think we've satisfied ourselves that even with the cliff, that we probably need another dorm. So there's a good medium-term planning process going on and debate going on with every big decision about, you know, what does the cliff mean for this particular situation? Should we slow roll this or should we speed it up? So those are the kinds of questions we're having as an executive team. We're also, you know, just like everybody else, thinking about and preparing our different units for what the possibilities might be in the future. So we're doing scenario planning about, well, if enrollment does this, what does it mean for your budgets? And so we're trying to have those conversations now so that they're not a surprise to anybody who has been here for 30 years and have seen nothing but a strong trajectory of growth. And we know what happens when you have nothing but strong trajectory of growth. Nobody has ever had a budget cut. They've never had to pull back on anything. And so we're trying to really create, you know, start to manage people's expectations about even if all we did was plateau, that's probably a different reality than what a lot of people are accustomed to. And so I think just having those conversations now, even as we go through this year's budget cycle, about what does 3 years from now look like or 4 years from now look like at your college? I mean, what are your own enrollment projections and what are you doing from a strategic standpoint to, you know, make the degree programs in different academic units appealing, and all the while trying to, again, maintain a reasonable cost level? We have not raised in-state tuition here in 2 years. We likely will this coming year because of our class and compensation study and other things that we have going on. But we don't want to just raise tuition for the sake of raising tuition because inflation says we can. We want to be good stewards, and we want to be more efficient and more productive across campus. And we're really challenging people to think differently about their organizations and how they can bring value to their business instead of just doing things the way we've always done them.
And what's the next 3 to 5 years look like for you personally?
That's a great question. I ask myself that a lot. You know, if you had asked me that question 3 years ago when I started this job, I would have told you, well, I told the chancellor at the time I would do this job for 3 years. That was what I was going to commit to.
Okay.
And so I've been here for 3.5. And I would tell you that I love the leadership team that I work with. And that means a lot about to the future. I mean, Chancellor Robinson could not be a better partner for me. Provost Martin, the other vice chancellors that I work with. We have, just like I mentioned earlier when I was talking about my career at Sam's, how important alignment is. I feel like this leadership team is super aligned. And we have candid, robust conversations that they are not political at all. We aren't beating around the bush. We say what needs to be said in a very constructive way, all with the lens of making the University of Arkansas stronger and better and more affordable for our students and becoming a important research vehicle for the state of Arkansas. So with that filter, it really allows us to have those candid conversations about how do those things, you know, whatever initiative comes up, how does it fit in there? And I find all of those conversations exciting. And I mentioned the things that I missed when I wasn't in a large organization around complexity and having a strong peer network. And I have both of those things here. The complexity in higher ed is more than what I would have expected. But I do kind of love it. And the problems that higher ed faces are wicked problems, and aren't easily solved. And that makes it exciting and makes it worth getting up in the morning and, as if the students weren't enough, right? I mean, so
right.
I think it's that, and of course, Razorback athletics. Get off without putting in the plug for Razorback athletics. I'm a huge sports fan, especially women's sports, and you'll basically see me behind the bench at every sporting event because I just thrive on it. And that's been one of the, even though I was already a season ticket holder for most sports before I came here. I love that aspect. It gives me a lot of passion and energy as well. So as long as Razorback athletics and the complexity and strong peer group are around, I think I'm going to stay engaged.
And staying, well, that's awesome. That is awesome. I'm sure they're going to be happy to hear that.
I would also say Nakubo has been a phenomenal organization to be a part of. And especially for somebody coming not from higher ed, without the higher ed. So I remember going to my first Nakubo conference and I thought, oh my God, I learned so much in that week. I developed a great peer network. And also I'll give a shout out to my SEC school peers because they are also a strong network that we depend on each other a lot. But between Nakubo and my SEC peers, I probably would have been as successful as I have in this job because they really both have given me such a great foundation and just places I can go and get information, thought leadership, and understand who's doing what around the country. So appreciate the work that Nakubo does.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so, so much. This has been great. We really enjoyed speaking with you today. Someone with such vast experience. It's just been a pleasure. Thank you, Anne.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's my pleasure to be part of this.
Awesome. Awesome. And we want to thank you all for joining us today for this episode of CBO Speaks, brought to you by the National Association of College and University Business Officers. You can find resources for today's episode, as well as a wide variety of research and tools at Nakubo.org. Make sure you subscribe to CBO Speaks wherever you get your podcasts, and so that you can get the latest episodes instantly. And on behalf of Anne Bordelone from the University of Arkansas, I want to thank you for joining us on CBO Speaks. I'm Donna Shealy. Be well.
CBO Speaks is a production of the National Association of College and University Business Officers. Audio engineered by Andy Nelson and True Story FM. Music by Michael Bean. post-production support by Janelle Dempsey. And I'm your host, Donna Shealy. Thank you for listening.